Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome David Pogue to the broadcast. David writes the tech column for the New York Times every week and in Scientific American every month. He's the host of Nova Science Now and other science shows on PBS, and he's been a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning since 2002. With over 3 million books in print, David is one of the world's best-selling how-to authors. He wrote or co-wrote 7 books in the Four Dummies series, including Max, Magic, Opera, and Classical Music. In 1999, he launched his own series of complete funny computer books called the Missing Manual series, which now includes 120 titles. David spent 10 years conducting and arranging Broadway musicals in New York. He's won an Emmy, a Lieb Award for Journalism, and an honorary doctorate in music. He's been profiled on 48 Hours and 60 Minutes. He lives in Connecticut with his 3 children, and his website is davidpogue.com. David graduated summa cum laude from Yale with distinction in music. Although David's focus is on personal technology, in the age of consumerization of IT, his opinions of what is useful and what is not often impacts the decisions that IT leaders make in the corporate world. If you'd like to see a video version of this interview, please visit forumonworldclassit.com. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Interested in learning a little bit more about how you have a sort of non-traditional path towards where you now sit. By way of education, you were a music major, although I did note that you studied computer science as well, so quite a diverse couple of things that you chose to focus on as an undergrad at Yale. But I'm wondering, especially in those early days, what was your relationship with technology?
I think the key to understanding my career is that I was never into technology. I, from the beginning, brought to this the outsider's point of view, which is why I write for a layman's publication and not for Maximum PC Magazine. My interest was always magic, believe it or not. From the time I was tiny, my favorite shows were Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. I became an amateur magician. I think it was something like 400 magic shows through my teen years for birthday parties and block parties. So my little self-analysis is that consumer technology is the closest thing we actually have to magic. You push a button and something happens at your command. In essence, from the first time I ever saw a remote control to speech recognition, the things that get me fired up the most are always the things that seem the most magical. Siri is fairly magical, and handwriting recognition and Microsoft Kinect is fairly magical. So those engineering triumphs always delight me the most.
In terms of creation, in terms of innovation, there's a lot of perhaps obvious ways in which technology and music might have some commonalities. Is there something within you that you see as sparking an interest in both those areas?
I don't think so. I think it's exactly what you said. I think it's just the more general brain similarities between technology and music. That's why a lot of doctors are musicians and so on. To me, I think that both computers and music are rule-based. There are strict rules that govern what you do, and yet they're creative on top of that. So I think that's the similarity there.
I know for a time you really pursued your passion for music in places like Broadway, among others. But then in 1988, you began to write for Macworld magazine, which, of course, is a very technical journal, not like the publication you work for now. Can you talk a bit about that pivot? What took you to Macworld? What was the logic in your own mind of going from one world to really a completely different one?
It actually wasn't as clean a break as it might sound. My music and writing careers actually overlapped for many, many years. I did both things. The first job I got when I got to New York City after college was as a part-time office manager position for the New York Mac User Group, or NYMUG. And it was my job to empty their post office box and distribute the mail and pay bills and so on. So they had a little 8-page Xerox newsletter they wittily called the Mac Street Journal. And one day I was bemoaning to the editor of this newsletter how much I wanted the world's first professional sheet music software. It was called Finale and still is, but it cost $1,000. You got 3 little floppy disks for $1,000. And I clearly couldn't afford that. But the guy said, this guy to whom, by the way, I owe my entire career now, he said, well, why don't you write the company and tell them you're our reviewer for music software? And can they send you a review copy? That's exactly what I did. And I mean, a light bulb went off. I couldn't believe it. They sent me a copy. I wrote about it. And then I did that a couple more times with, again, graphic software and music software. And finally, that same guy, same editor said, you know, this is probably not in my own best interest, but you probably could be getting paid for this. Why don't you send your clippings from the Mac Street Journal to the glossy computer magazines and see what happens? That's how the Macworld thing happened. They happened to be looking for someone who could do music and art software at that time. So it was just a lucky timing thing. And again, I was not a technical person. To this day, I could not take a computer apart and put it back together again. I don't code. I don't pretend to be a computer engineer. So that's, of course, a terrible weakness if you're a techie online, or my greatest virtue if you're a layman reading my columns, because I'm one of them.
Exactly. No, that makes sense. Before we leave your time at Macworld, I think it's interesting that you were there during quite an interesting time for Apple. That is, you were covering it during its darkest days, and also through to the time when Steve Jobs returned. And I wonder just if you have any insights from that period, covering it at a time when it was really reaching its nadir, and then bringing the founder back and sort of the rebirth of the organization.
Yeah, it was disturbing to me for two reasons. One, it was half my income. During the later years, I was writing the back page column. It was a kind of a humor column, and I got a lot of satisfaction and a lot of visibility from it. But also, I've always been a champion of elegance and simplicity, and I've always felt that Apple in those days, and now there's other companies like it, but Apple in particular paid attention to design and sweated the details and, you know, all that stuff that Steve Jobs used to talk about, the zen of design and simplicity and knowing what to leave out. I'm a huge believer in that philosophy, whatever company does it. So it was really disappointing to me that my fellow Americans could not see that, that they couldn't embrace what was clearly artistically a superior philosophy. So I was sort of disappointed that, you know, but I can buy a Dell for $400, you know, that argument immediately shut down any meaningful conversation about crafts and art.
When you joined the New York Times in 2000, can you talk a little bit about the genesis of that opportunity, how that came about? Obviously, a very major periodical and a great perch to continue your writing and to reach a much broader audience. But how did that come about?
That's exactly right. That's exactly how I saw it. The tech columnist at the time was Peter Lewis, and he created this column, and he was terrific at it. But he got an offer at a magazine where he would have much greater powers and have to write less often, and he would have a staff, and he loved the idea. I believe that he submitted my name as a candidate. He had been a reader of my Macworld column for a long time, and I'd done writing for the Times already as a book reviewer. Whenever they got a history of AOL, you know, a book like that, they would ask if I would want to review it. So that's really all I know about how it happened, other than to say that it was a very long process. It was 10 editors that I met over maybe 6 months. And then one day it was the biggest anticlimax in the world. The technology editor one day emailed and said, hey, we're going to run that most recent sample column you wrote. And, you know, if you want to keep doing it, we'd love it. I'm like, sure. So, and it's really been the greatest job in the world. I mean, it's everything that you think the New York Times would be, everything you hear that the New York Times is in terms of dedication to excellence and getting it right and superb writing and being fresh with the story. I mean, all of that stuff turns out to be true. And they've given me leeway that I never expected in terms of my writing style. They let me use contractions, for example, and make some really appalling puns. They've been very nurturing that way.
That's great. I want to talk a little bit about your process. So first of all, how would you define what you will review and what you will not? What is sort of the breadbasket for you?
The original assignment for the column 13 years ago is still, even though I'm on my third editor now, or fourth editor, the assignment has always served me well, which is, first of all, in choosing what you review, we want news. So the first, the smallest, the fastest, the best, the most unusual. So those tend to be the things I write about. If I hear about one more Bluetooth speaker, I'm going to slit my wrists. It would have to be solar powered or underwater or the size of your fingernail, but fills the room. I don't know. It would have to be something special. And the other part of the assignment was, we're not interested in the technology. We're interested in the intersection of the technology with society and culture and people. You'll notice in every one of these columns, it's not about, you know, the bus speeds or the how many gigabytes it has. It's about how you'll use it and how it fits into your life. And that's much of the source of the humor, too. When I reviewed last week a 27-inch touchscreen tablet from Lenovo, I tried to picture, what are your kids in the backseat going to think of handing them a 19-pound tablet? It's good for some things and eyebrow-raising in some other ways.
Exactly, exactly. What is your process? How do you get into the guts of something? You mentioned you don't take things apart and put them back together. What sort of time do you take with it? Do you reach out and get into the companies who are producing things while things are still in their idea state? How early are you involved? How do you kind of kick in the tires once you get a hold of something?
Well, there's really two phases of it. One is planning the review, figuring out what it's going to be for next week. And really the most I ever plan out is maybe 3 weeks, because news breaks. You want it to be fresh. So I'll discuss the idea with my editor, and she'll say, I like this one, I like this one. Then I contact the company involved and say, can you loan me one of these? As you're probably aware, I don't get to keep anything. It's not the manufacturer who cares about getting the product back. You know, I'm sure Apple would love to have me seen walking around holding an iPhone, but it's the New York Times who cares very deeply, so they're extremely strict about that. So I find the PR person and say, I'd like to review this. Can you send me one for a couple of weeks? And they send it, and, you know, often they'll say, we'd like to come to your house and walk you through it, and I really don't like that. The experience I have should be the experience of the poor sap who just bought it from Amazon is opening it up on the kitchen table. And that's what I like to do. So how is the manual? How long does it take to charge? Are all the pieces where you expect to find them? You know, the whole thing. So I just like to pretend I got one for my birthday and I plug it in and test it out. That usually starts, you know, the week before. It depends on what it is. If it's a fitness bracelet that takes weeks of data, I'll start weeks ahead. And the amount of time it takes also varies wildly. If it's a speaker, you play a whole bunch of different kinds of music, a bunch of different places in the house, a whole bunch of different volumes, compare it with the speaker you already have, you know, it's a day, half a day. But if it's, you know, when it was the iPad, something totally new, you had no frame of reference already, it took a lot longer.
And to what extent are the opinions that you're rendering fully representative of the choices you might make? I would imagine that somebody who is so deeply imbued in technology might have kind of the equivalent of the musician who has extraordinary speakers that no layman ever would have, and it has a degree of taste that others simply can't appreciate. And so I'm curious, to what extent are there instances where you might not like a product or not think it's practical for the average user, but that it is actually everything that you need because your exposure to technology means your degree of sophistication is a few notches above at least the average technology users might be?
I would hope not. I'm routinely savaged by the technical intelligentsia for not being a speeds and feeds guy, for not slamming such and such a product, for not having a high enough megahertz rating. But that's because my religion is being the reader. I mean, that is top to bottom. If I think it's something that delights me, the very first instinct in my head is, but is that typical? So if it's something unique to me, I would rule it out as a criterion. I think I am pretty much like a technically enthusiastic consumer. I have to buy everything myself. You know what? This might even be the answer right here. The best thing ever is to get an email from a reader that says, I bought the thing you told me to get and I'm so happy. I mean, that's really the ultimate level. I really don't care about the companies who make this stuff. I really don't care in the end about New York Times or its bottom line. I care about getting the email from somebody for whom the tech product works just as I hoped it would. And, you know, it's a great product and they love it. In the end, that's what I live for. So I wouldn't do anything to jeopardize that. Sometimes I'm not in a position to judge that. For example, I'm not an audiophile. So sometimes I'll invite people over to the house to help me assess something using their expertise, for example, or a professional photographer when it's designed for a slightly higher end audience.
Can you talk a bit about how you developed your personal brand? You have nearly 1.5 million followers on Twitter. You've done such an amazing job of using traditional media and new media. You do television, you do obviously newspaper writing, you do all sorts of digital forms of media as well. How have you thought about that process of developing your own personal brand now on the back end of having done so successfully?
Well, thank you. If you think I have a brand, I can assure you it was nothing I ever set out to do. Never for a second. All I've ever done is answer the phone and say yes. And these things tend to trickle down. You know, once the New York Times job came along, then when CBS News needed a tech guy, it was an obvious call. And sometimes these things aren't related at all. You know, the hosting the Nova show, well, that's a science show. That's got nothing to do with gadgets. So that came from a totally different channel of just basically being an inquisitive show off. I mean, I guess the one transferable skill is translating technical or difficult concepts to the layman, for whom I think I have a pretty good sense at this point. There was never, ever any effort to build a brand or to seek out work. I mean, I've never thought to myself, now, next I should start a website. In fact, I guess that's the really pathetic thing, is that I've never in my life, except for that first sending to the computer magazines in 1987, I've never in my life sought.
And as you pointed out, that was thanks to somebody else as well.
Yeah, that's right.
So it really has been more reactive than proactive. You climbed from perch to perch, so to speak, and especially as you find yourself in such a prominent perch at the New York Times, naturally others have come to call, liking your style, liking what you've written, seeing the translation from what you've done into some adjacent areas, as you just pointed out with the Nova example. But it's been largely reactive as opposed to proactive.
Almost 100%. I was writing for Macworld, and Macworld had a sister company that was going to do computer books, and they had one mega hit. It was DOS for Dummies. So the publisher of that sister company said, you know, we should really have a second book, a second Dummies book about that other computer, the Mac. So where is he going to go? He went to Macworld magazine and said, who do you got who can write entertainingly for the layman? You know, they gave him my name and he called. And so, I mean, literally every single one of these things came from somebody else just calling up. So I've been super lucky. Let's just be truthful.
That's really incredible. And given the wide array of things that you do on a day-to-day basis, the incredible number of books that you've written, how do you plan your week or plan your month? I mean, how do you divide up time so that you're making progress against each of the various commitments that you have that are so different? In some cases, the synergies are almost difficult to translate. So it's not as though you're working on one thing that's feeding two different objectives necessarily. How do you think about that process? Are you just incredibly well organized, for instance?
I'd say I'm asked this question a fair amount, and I think it boils down to three things. One is, at this point, I would be lost without my assistant. I have this incredible assistant, Jan Carpenter, who does so much of the headroom in a normal career. So all the flights, all the finances, all the contracts, all the bills, product ordering, product returning, just an insane amount of stuff that would occupy the normal person's day, leaving me to do just the creative, which is an incredible gift. The second thing is I really do fancy myself an expert in time management and time shifting. Someone else might think of an airplane ride or a wait in the airplane lounge as downtime. To me, those are prime working times. And everything that I do is portable. So the Scientific America column, the New York Times column, the blogs. I am now doing these 1-minute videos for the Times. And, you know, those are just done in hotel rooms. If there's the light's not good, I'll go out into the parking lot. Always, always processing and time shifting. Part of that category is I'm a extreme macro user and typing expanding user and shortcut user. So I work entirely by keystrokes. In other words, I don't use the menus. I don't use the mouse. Everything is from the keyboard. I force myself to learn those stupid keystrokes because I know that over time it'll pay off. I have a typing expander with something like 700 abbreviations stored that I have now memorized in muscle memory. Some are entire paragraphs. Some I send to a hater, you know, guess we'll have to agree to disagree. Thanks for the note. You know, it's just so, and all the common words, you, the, computer, phone, iPhone, Android, all of those are one letter abbreviations for me. So I use that. I use I use Evernote as the basis for every column idea list, for every brainstorm, for every funny opening paragraph idea, for directions and phone numbers and everything. That, of course, synchronizes from computer to phone to computer, so it's everywhere. I use macro software all over the place. So opening programs is just a matter of keystrokes. Really big into the efficiency software space. So in that way, maybe I'm giving the lie to my previous answer about how much does my own situation affect my recommendations. You know, maybe it's just because I'm so short for time that was especially appealing to me, but I'm hearing from a lot of people that are also benefiting, so that's good. And then the final thing is I really am not a writer's block person. I don't stare at the screen, and I write really fast. I write like I talk. People meet me and they're like, oh my God, you write just like you talk. You talk just like you write. Thank goodness for that. Maybe it's just a lifelong terror of deadlines that drives me, but I don't spend a lot of time spinning my wheels. I'm a pretty quick writer.
As much as you write, I would almost expect that you don't have much time to read, but I'm sure you do find some time. And I'm actually curious, what do you read and who do you read? Who are some people who are influential with you?
Most of what I read is magazines, just to keep on top of it. So Sound and Vision and Laptop Magazine and Esquire. And some of those are tech publications that just let me know about the new products coming down the pipe. So that's airplane stuff when you can't use your electronic. In terms of books, I'm in the bizarre position of writing many more than I read. I mean, every year I do 4 or 5 books, and I'll be lucky to read one. But I just got married a month ago, and we went on a 2-week incredible non-electronic vacation to Italy, and we promised ourselves that every other day we would stay home in this amazing villa that a friend loaned us and read. And so I got through some really great books. There's this Maria Semple book called Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which had been recommended to me, A, because she's a former writer for Arrested Development and screamingly funny, and B, because I am a character in it. I have a one-page cameo. Turns out I can recommend the book even without that. I finally read The Corrections, Jonathan Franzen, and that was a mind-blower. I want to read him next, his next one. And then I read some books that my teenage daughter had been begging me to read, her favorite books, by this guy, John Green, who is a huge guru and hero to teenage girls in particular, and he's written some just amazing, amazing novels. So I finally read those and enjoyed them thoroughly.
Did you have any sort of detox period necessary as you were going off of technology? Was there a point at which you didn't know what to do with your hands, or you were breaking out into cold sweats without having kind of an update from somewhere in some far distance through technology?
I guess I really didn't. I can go a few days without it. There was an old DSL line in the corner of the house that was like a 300 baud modem that you could download emails every other day and scrape by, make sure there weren't any brush fires. So it wasn't 100% cold turkey.
Are there any trends, any new technologies that particularly excite you, even just sort of broad categories, as you think about months and years out, some things that you're just starting to catch wind of? What are some of the things that particularly excite you?
Clearly, people are starting to talk about technology that you wear. The wristbands are coming on strong. The glasses are interesting. The watches people are talking about. I'm especially interested in the quantified self movement. These are the wristbands and clothing clips that measure your activity, your sleep, some of them your food, your heart rate, your blood oxygen, and so on. So people are starting to crunch the data about their own health, their own fitness. And it was a revelation to me. You wear one of these things and you suddenly are constantly aware of how sedentary you are. And you suddenly become aware of ways that you could overcome that without changing your routine. You know, park farther away or vow to take the stairs if it's, you know, under 7 floors or whatever. And it's the same effect as an experiment where they put a thermostat on the wall where, in addition to the temperature, it put dollars a day. So when you see how much you're using in terms of money, wow, that same kind of idea, and it's really effective. I'm totally nuts for that. For the average person to see what their sleep patterns are like, you know, oh my gosh, I never realized that even though I seem to sleep 8 hours a night,
I'm waking up 7 times. What's that about? So it's fascinating in a whole new realm. And then I think the Google Glasses idea isn't a slam dunk. It's too socially awkward in a lot of ways. I could be wrong, but I've been acutely uncomfortable whenever I talk to someone wearing them because you don't know if they're filming. Clearly, people are working on wearable. The portable touchscreen thing, phones and tablets and in between, is clearly just in its infancy. What these things are capable of, the battery life, the speed, the durability, the price, all of that will improve. I mean, this is year 3 of the iPad clone. So these are going to look like the Commodore 64 in a couple of years.
Well, David Polk, thank you so much for taking this time. It's been really great talking to you and learning a bit about your history, your methods, some of your thoughts and pontifications about the future. I really appreciate you spending this time with us.
My pleasure.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the value of a connected ecosystem to inspire innovation for tomorrow. To learn more, visit redhat.com. Listen to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' 5 principles of World Class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The 2nd principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The 3rd principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The 4th principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the 3 prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The 5th and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the 4th principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these 5 principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. Our editors are Chris Davis and Calhan Cool, and our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.